Hey, this is post-production Matthew Marissa. Content warnings for this episode include discussions on mass suicide. As always, content warnings will be listed in the descriptions as well with timestamps provided, and we will let you know when it comes up in the episode proper. Enjoy!
I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web. Computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Hello, welcome to NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web. I'm your host, Matthew Marissa.
And I'm, of course, your co-host, Galen.
And it's been a hot minute.
Yeah.
We still exist.
Technically, it's been a cold minute because it's coming up to be fall as of right now.
See, I want to yes and you, but I also want to question your logic because our sort of hiatus has been in summer.
That is true. It was a hot minute, and now it is becoming cold.
Yes, okay. You realize you've put me in a bit of a predicament here.
Yeah, I have put you in a bit of predicament, but the one thing that I haven't put you in is a bind.
Yeah, good. I'm saving that for the special someone.
Yeah.
Look, okay. I wanted to not do a cold open, and then this happened. So, yeah, it's been a hot minute, but there's good reasons that we don't need to talk about. Instead, we need to talk about a topic that I think in some ways has been long overdue, but also hasn't, because this is something that I kind of made you watch recently. But for good reason, because this is we're talking about a series that is getting a continuation after like 8 or 9 years or something.
Yeah, this is a series that is relevant to the internet in kind of an abstract sense. Probably specifically the like weeaboo or like, you know, anime manga side of the internet. But beyond that is also just a very good series that, like you said, is finally getting a continuation. And so we are talking about the main show series and the first major movie of
Puella Magi Madoka Magica. But before we talk about that, we have to talk about a whole genre of anime and manga and live action produced in Japan. A whole media genre. We need to talk about magical girls.
Does it mean that's time for the Fact Corner?
The Fact Corner.
So I'm taking a lot of this off of some work done by Gabriella Ekins that she wrote for Anime News Network, as well as just some other like retrospectives on the genre. But essentially, magical girls, the way to describe it to somebody who doesn't watch a lot of anime would be Sailor Moon. Sailor Moon is so well known that it was in a Bare Naked Ladies song.
Like, yeah, the vision of anime in the 90s was boys like Dragon Ball Z, or just Dragon Ball, I'm not entirely sure, and girls like Sailor Moon.
Yeah. Magical girls, you can think of them as the like cute girl version of superheroes.
Yeah.
Which is very on purpose. They gain powers, they fight monsters and evildoers using magic that is often related to positive connotations or positive emotions.
You could also make a connection to Sentai series, which, if you don't know what anime are, Sentai series are Power Rangers.
Yeah. Okay, so essentially, the thing about magical girls, though, is that it has a really interesting history in that there is a pretty strict divide in what it was, like what a magical girl is and means and the tropes associated, because there are really two main sort of foundational works in the genre, which were Himitsu no Akko-chan and Sally the Witch, though the latter of which, their anime was a way more influential for the early magical girl, or Maho Shoujo, which is essentially magical girl in Japanese, genre. The thing about these is that they didn't even have, like, fighting or monsters, really. These were more about girls who were magical, but were in, like, everyday scenarios, like a witch being sent to go to normal human school. But they use their magic to either help people or to get into misadventures, which is, I would compare it to like Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Yeah, yeah.
a lot of these were also inspired by a particular Japanese dub of the sitcom Bewitched, which I think is a very apt, like a very visible starting point when you compare it to these sort of early Magical Girl series. Though what is important to note is that a lot of these early ones still had two major tropes, which are the little cute mascot characters, who are often either like beings who grant power to the girl, or they are like underlings of the girl.
Yeah, like some kind of symbol of the power.
Yeah. Also, these featured a lot of transformations. I believe Sally the Witch was the one where she would transform into like an older version of herself, but this was sort of a way to get women interested in joining the workforce by being like, here's her dressed up in an office worker's outfit. Here's her dressed up in this type of thing. And it's like,
kind of like a like Barbie style.
Sort of, yeah, Barbie style feminist Rosie the Riveter workforce towards girls.
That's really interesting. I never would have connected that.
Now, there is another series that I think is also cited as being connected to the legacy of Magical Girls, but despite not being one, which is a manga in 1952 by the great Osamu Tezuka, Princess Knight, which is a series in which a princess who also has the heart of a boy in her, like, dresses up sort of androgynously in boys' fashion and goes on adventures as a knight. There's elements of gender there as well. That's,
yeah, yeah.
In some ways, like, is gender essentialism, but also is progressive for the time.
It's the kind, like, it was made in the 1950s, so it clearly has the very heteronormative, you know, boy and girl. But it also is like,
I don't know if I'd call that heteronormative. Binary normative?
Yeah, yeah. Gender binary, like boy and girl.
Boy
and
is strong, girl is emotional.
Yeah. But much with a lot of, you know, early media like that, you can look back on it and go, this was progressive for the time. We probably didn't have the words to be like, yeah, she's even a tomboy. Or, you know, modern day, it might be, oh, she was trans. Back then it would be, yes, she's a girl, but she has the heart of a boy, and she goes on adventures.
Yeah, except she literally has the heart of a boy. I don't need to get into this, we don't need to litigate this. I'm not trying to say any value judgments about Osamu Tezuka,
yeah, yeah.
Who is by all intents and purposes a great writer, very important to the medium as a whole, but also to this genre. I think the important thing, though, is that Princess Knight was one of the earliest action series for girls. It had a lot of things in it that were geared towards boys, such as the sort of medieval sword fighting fantasy, but also the way the character dresses is sort of fashion heavy and is a little flamboyant by masculine standards, especially at the time. I think this aspect means that it was sort of geared towards all audiences, but definitely leans more towards action series for girls.
Yeah.
Who wanted to be represented by more media than just, you know, girls' slice of life stuff. Now, Sailor Moon is the one that actually shifted this, that instead of Magical Girls being about girls going on misadventures with their friends, they were the action series for girls.
Yeah, instead of Action Commando, it is now...
Yeah.
I wish I had a different Schwarzenegger film could reference.
It's more like, instead of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, it is Zatanna?
Spider-Man?
I was trying to go with a female superhero, but sure. Spider-Gwen.
Yeah.
It was the idea that, like I said, with Princess Knight, action can also be for girls. Whereas previously, action had almost entirely been marketed towards boys. As you mentioned, the Super Sentai element of characters who transform into a costume to fight bad guys. There is, like, Kamen Rider, and Super Sentai is specifically the series that Power Rangers was copied from,
yeah.
I guess.
Was, in a sense, complicated.
Tokusatsu is technically the genre name. Sentai right. Also gets thrown around as sort of a colloquialism, but tokusatsu is, it's a Kleenex in napkin situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Sailor Moon's big things, it has the cute mascot character who grants the main character her powers. She fights with her friends against evildoers. She does have very feminine aspects, such as her fashion, and there is a big focus on things like makeup. She transforms using, like, magic lipstick. But it is ultimately done in service of making her empowering. The character Usagi, the, like, titular Sailor Moon, is very, like, feisty and go-getter, very upfront.
Yeah.
An archetype that is
She is not a passive character. Yeah.
Very assertive. And so while there are elements that are very, like, hyper-feminine, it's almost more like you don't have to view those as weakness. Those can be a statement that fits with you.
Yeah.
Sailor Moon, very popular, not just with girls, but also with boys for a number of reasons, but also popular with Americans.
Yeah.
It sort of became a global phenomenon, not just with America and Japan, but with tons of other places. And this all happened before the, like, big anime boom of the 2000s.
Yeah.
Like I said, it was mentioned in the Bare Naked Ladies song, One Week. That's a song from, like, the 90s.
Yeah, I do think about that every now and again, that, like, the two songs I can think of off the top of my head that reference anime are the Bare Naked Ladies song and Otaku Hot Girl by Megan Thee Stallion.
Yeah. Honestly, those are opposite songs.
Yeah.
In every way.
And Megan Thee Stallion could never meet the heights of Bare Naked Ladies.
That's not at all what I said. Yeah. So yeah, I mentioned Sailor Moon was in 91, and there were a number of other Magical Girl series after that point. The biggest one in 2004 was Pretty Cure, which has since become, like, the longest-running Magical Girl series, the biggest one, the, like, most money-making, the most popular, the like, biggest.
Yeah, it is the...
It gets new sequels or spin-offs every year. It is part of the yearly anime cycle. It is definitely geared more towards girls, but it is also somehow more action-focused than Sailor Moon. Pretty Cure is, by all intents and purposes, a superhero show for girls, and it's a huge thing. One of my favorite, like, bits in a author interview is that Eiichiro Oda, creator of One Piece, said his daughter likes Pretty Cure more than One Piece. And I think that's great. So yeah, Pretty Cure is a huge one, but also, interestingly, 2004 had one of the first, like, deconstructions of Magical Girl, which was Magical Girl Lyrical Nanoha. It's not really a deconstruction that subverts tropes. It's more so that it subverts the idea that magical girls are for kids, in that it has very dark themes around, like, super soldiers in, like, global warfare.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
A real Code Geass situation.
Yeah, it was based off of a eroge.
Oh.
An erotic visual novel, so you don't necessarily have to watch it.
Oh, so is Fate Stay Night, so...
Well, okay, yeah. But just keep in mind, I think that Magical Girl series have had dark twists, which will be important. If you know anything about Madoka, you will already know where we're going,
yeah,
and what I mean. But I think it's interesting that even as early as 2004, which was 13 years after Sailor Moon premiered, it was already getting these sorts of new takes. You could say that the people who were, like, teenagers when Sailor Moon was happening then grew up and started to become adults and look for these darker things.
Yeah.
We mentioned that Sailor Moon was big outside of Japan. I think nowadays you'll find that there's a huge Magical Girl influence on Western shows. There are cartoons like Bee and Puppy Cat, which is directly in the genre.
Yep.
Steven Universe, which borrows a lot from the genre.
Yes, rather famously.
Yeah. And shows like OKKO, or I believe Craig of the Creek, have a lot of references to Magical Girls. I also want to shout out a recent pilot that went pretty popular online by Kiana Mai, titled I Don't Want to Be a Magical Girl, where a girl who is tired of being a magical girl befriends a magical girl nerd who always wanted to be one. It's a very great pilot, very cute show. Highly recommend checking it out. It's like 20 minutes. That pilot, interestingly, also is very popular among the Japanese-speaking internet audience.
Nice.
Like, it feels like even half the comments on its YouTube page are in Japanese, which I think shows that, like, this isn't something that is rooted in Japanisms, I guess. This is a genre that is easy to understand without having full cultural connotation.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that it started as a imitation of Bewitched, or inspired by Bewitched, is clear enough, because that is an American show that was dubbed into Japanese, and then they're like, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
You could also almost say that those are both imitations or inspired by A Midsummer's Night's Dream, in which characters with magic go on misadventures. But maybe I'm just too Shakespeare-pilled for that.
I think YouTuber Bumbles McFumbles made a salient point during a Dragon Ball Z video, which was that Dragon Ball ended up breaking through in the West, or ended up being targeted specifically in the Western market, because of its similarities to existing superhero media. And so I kind of am wondering if that is sort of true in that reverse sense of, like, Magical Girl appeals, in a sense, because it's immediately actionable. In the same way that, you know, a Danny Phantom, a Spider's Man is immediately actionable to a young audience, you can immediately kind of see yourself in that role of, I'm just a girl, I'm just a boy, in the middle of high school,
yeah,
but I've got these wacky obligations.
It's essentially, yeah, it's fantasy that has representation.
Yeah.
It is also... A billion tropes have followed this. The double life sort
yeah,
of
yep.
situation. The sort of magical realist of real life meets strange thing. It's so common as a storytelling trope that it's not necessarily originated from superheroes, magical girls, witches.
Yeah.
Any of that. Shakespeare might have originated it. Who knows? But I do want to say one thing before we get to the main topic, because that sort of brings us to today, is that Magical Girl series are popular and exist in a cross-cultural dialogue.
Yep.
It is still worth noting, though, as I mentioned with Magical Lyrical Nanoha, that there is an amount of male gaze to it. And, like,
yes,
I'm not saying this as a fuck men sort of deal. I'm sometimes a man. That you can write that down on my credit card.
I'm usually a man.
So, like... I specifically mean this in that there are aspects where they are catered to horny guys.
Yeah.
Who, again, I'm trying to be nice about this and clear about what I am specifically referring to, but think about a lot of expensive anime figures. Those kind of have a reputation about the type of people who buy a lot of them.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a great stereotype, because, like, buying things from things you like is fine, but, like, there's definitely a type of guy who will buy statues of magical girls because he wants them in 3D.
Yeah.
It's that this is, like, a series that is about female empowerment that also has heavy ties to fashion, but unfortunately, pretty much anything that is, like, empowering for women becomes an object of desire for men especially.
Yeah. It's one of those unfortunate little things. Something that I was going to bring up, and I kind of want to, like, state it and then discard it as quickly as possible, which is that Madoka is unfortunately one of those anime, kind of like Kaon, that has a bit of a reputation where if you see a Madoka profile picture, it is somebody, you know, it is a random person online who is probably very racist.
Yeah.
And... like, I will separate this from the previous thing that you just said, but I will also say that I think it's one of those unfortunate cases where there is a reality to it, and it is also a reality that probably shouldn't, like, it should not be the reality that stops, you know, the genuine admirers, the genuine fans yeah. of something. Especially as well, like, I do think it's kind of a strange tightrope to walk sometimes, because Magical Girl series can, and, like, I'm maybe not the person to make this argument, but Magical Girl series can absolutely be, like, a metaphor for or deal with topics of, like, young girl sexuality. You know, especially the whole, like, transforming into a different person that is, you know, bigger and more powerful and whatnot. Like, there is elements there that you could easily play with from a thematic standpoint, and that would be really good for a, you know, a young female audience, but would also be, unfortunately, very gazy and very, like, maybe appeal towards the people it shouldn't TM.
Yeah, it's not a problem with, like, men as a whole. It's not a problem with anime as a whole. It is a problem with, dare I say, patriarchal standards that tend to view women as objects of desire and not as their own people.
Yep. And while there's maybe also a discussion to have of, like, whether the benefit outweighs the cost, so to speak, I also think that that is not a conversation for this podcast.
Yeah.
We are going to take an under assumption that if you are reading this, A, you're not racist.
B, you are choosing to read a transcript instead of the audio.
And C, you can understand the nuance of it is cool and good for young girls to have a good series and a good, you know, not product.
Role model.
Yeah, a good role model, a good, you know, space for them to explore themselves while also allowing for the separation of that, and people can sometimes be shitty. And sometimes companies can be shitty, you know, sometimes the major company plays into it, let's just say.
Yeah.
Again, whole other conversation. Yeah.
But I think that's about it for the overall genre, but now we can finally talk about the actual series.
Yes.
Cruella Maggi Madoka Magica. It was created by Magia Quartet, which is a sort of group or collective name comprised of Akiyuki Shinbo, the director, Gen Urobuchi, the writer, Ume Aoki, the character designer, and then the entire animation studio, Shaft. Shinbo had previously directed the anime adaptation of Aoki's manga Hidamari Sketch under Studio Shaft, leading the two to sort of want to collaborate more. And this was especially the case when Shinbo expressed interest in making a new Magical Girl series. Shinbo had also directed the adaptation of Nanoha, by the way. So he had already done a Magical Girl series before, but not an original one. By the way, Hidamari Sketch is a sort of slice of life series, very cute, about girls who go to art school. They have giant rectangular faces. I'm sorry, but that's like the big thing that always sticks out to me when I see it, is their faces are wide.
Yeah, I was about to say, when you say rectangular, are we talking like the very classic anime, like, you know, big eye, small mouth, sort of like 4x3 face?
Hidamari Sketch helped popularize it.
Oh no. Oh yeah, that is absolutely that style. Oh my goodness, that is.
Yeah. And of course, like, when they get more, like...
like, chibi,
it becomes even more rectangular. But yeah. Come on. But so, the producer, Atsuhiro Iwakami, introduced Shinbo to Gen Urobuchi, who had just finished writing the Fate Zero light novel.
Oh.
So that's a fun callback. Thank you for setting me up for that. That Gen Urobuchi had actually written what is considered, I believe, one of the better Fate spinoffs, though. That's just from secondhand.
This is the part where I make a disparaging comment about Fate as a series.
Yeah. So Atsuhiro Iwakami kind of was instrumental in creating this dream team, but afterwards he decided to go very hands-off and let the team sort of do their thing. I want to mention that a lot of this is from a Madoka Magica, like, art book, source book, production book, like a guide to Madoka Magica book that was released after the series.
Is how we know a lot of these details.
Yeah. As well as a ton of interviews. All the people involved have done a lot of interviews over the years because this is a very influential show.
Yeah, very big, very famous.
Yeah. The one thing is that Iwakami wanted Urobuchi's screenplay to be very dark and heavy with violence and death, whereas Urobuchi was going in expecting, like, oh, I guess I'm writing a cute Magical Girl series. But Iwakami was like, no, you did Fate Zero. Make it dark. It's funny, there is an anecdote in that Madoka guidebook that Urobuchi was like, he had trouble writing, because having read and seen Hidamari's sketch, he felt like it was bullying to try to kill her Aoki's characters. It's like, this feels like I'm bullying the Hidamari sketch characters. Now, he was having trouble coming up with, like, you know, a tone and atmosphere as well, until he saw another of Shinbo's directorial works that I believe was done with Shaft, a horror OVA series called Le Portrait de Petite Cosette, which is a sort of gothic horror with a girl as the main character. That sort of gave Urobuchi the jumping off point of what the tone and mood of all this would be. Also, very importantly, there is an animation duo called Gekidan Inukuri, which do stop-motion animation in a very sort of Czech, Polish style, very collage-focused, with sort of heavy textures. They have done a lot of work with Shaft, even before Madoka. They did a lot of stop-motion on Zetsubou Sensei and Maria. And that aspect helped cement this gothic horror concept being used for the magical girls. Additionally, Gekidan Inukuri would essentially get full reign of certain aspects of the anime, which we'll discuss eventually. I guess I'll just say the labyrinths and the witches.
Yeah.
If you know what those are, then you'll be able to connect those. We'll explain those a bit later. But they had pretty much full reign of, like, the character designs for those things and the location and background designs for those things. And that, with the gothic horror concepts that Urobuchi was working with, were a perfect fit. Like, actually just, like, moi.
Yeah.
So it's not even a quartet at this point. It's at least a sextet, if not a septet, of Urobuchi, Aoki, Shinbo, Gekidan Inukuri, which are a duo, producer Iwakami, and then the entire staff of Studio Shaft. Yeah. I think Gekidan Inukuri also did some work on Bakemonogatari, which was another Shaft project, but I don't remember exactly. Shinbo wanted to market the series as being a normal magical girl anime. He posted on Twitter saying that while Gen Urobuchi's writing this, the plot would be normal. This is going to be a normal series. And interestingly, this worked really well for Urobuchi, who wrote a sort of general plot outline, a storytelling structure not just for Madoka, but multiple other things. He likes the first episode to have a late hook that doesn't get answered until the second episode. Mm. And then the third episode throws a giant wrench in that then triggers the rest of the series. This will be extremely apparent as we go through the episodes of Madoka. So this all sort of harmonized together really well, and even the anime opening throughout the entire run of the series plays into this as well, of being an opening that looks like a typical magical girl opening, including scenes that are not present in the anime proper.
Yes.
Like a billion, there's so much you could say about the opening as a bait and switch. It is one of the famous bait and switches in anime. See, also, is it School Live? Gakko Garashi? I only know the Japanese name, but that's another famous bait and switch. But it seemed to do well for Madoka. It premiered on January 7th, 2011. And would complete its 12-episode run on April 22nd of 2011. And in 2013, a sequel movie, Madoka Magica Rebellion, was released. That is what we're going to be talking about today, is that span.
Yes.
Also, before Rebellion, there were two OVA episodes that combined and shortened the series proper. These are also called movies, but it's essentially just that has a whole other meaning with anime, but they're essentially like cut together versions of the series that are quicker to get through.
Yeah. Do you have the time to watch about, you know, a movie, a straight to, you know, DVD movie, but not the time to watch an entire anime series? Just watch this and then the previous movie and you're good.
This is somewhat common with anime, from what I've seen.
Yeah.
It's worth noting, though, that also there were a number of video games that were spawned, including the 2017 mobile game Magia Record, which is like a complete spinoff that would then get its own anime adaptation in 2020, which we will not be talking about. But the reason that I made Galen watch this is because in, I believe, 2022, or maybe 23, maybe 24, it was recently, they announced they were working on the movie, Madoka Magica Walpurgis Knot Rising, and it's set to release in February of next year.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you how excited I've been, how thrilled I was to see that it was even confirmed, because I thought the series was done, and knowing that it's this close, like,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
It was a triple whammy of, like, we have to cover this.
Yeah. Okay, so with that in mind, we can begin talking about episode 1 of Puella Magi Madoka Magica.
Episode 1!
Episode 1 starts with Madoka at her house. Her family is great. Shoutouts to Madoka's mom.
Yep. Shout out to Madoka's mom and Madoka's dad. We got a girl boss mom and male wife father.
It's just like Johnny Test.
It really is. Also, I do want to very specifically highlight a really early scene, which is really cute, where Madoka, like, washes her face and then is, like, reaching for the towel. We cut to a close-up of her reaching for the towel, and then her mom, I think, silently just, like, moves it a little bit closer.
Yeah.
It's really sweet, and it's a really, like, immediate symbolism of just, like, you know, the little ways in which the mom is, you know, passing things on and helping the daughter.
Also, I just want to say, their bathroom is wild.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a greenhouse.
Yeah, it's a bathroom that's as big as a fucking living room.
And I think all the walls are glass.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And it feels like a mansion or like some rich, like, expenditure.
Yeah. Hey, Madoka, wanna go play soccer in our massive bathroom?
Pretty much. It's like something you would make in The Sims as a joke. Yeah. Of, like, what if this was in an actual house? So that's pretty great. But Madoka goes to school, and she's kind of lonely and, well, not lonely, she has friends, but she's kind of reserved and quiet.
Yeah, Madoka has a group of two friends, Sayaka and Hitomi.
Mm-hmm.
But besides that, she is just sort of like, you know, an average high school girl.
Mm-hmm. That some people understand.
Yeah.
At least. But when they sit down for class with their teacher, who is a complete, like, girl failure.
Yeah.
All the side characters in this series are great.
They really are. I don't know if the teacher will really come back up again, but the teacher constantly has terrible luck with men, and so, like, every new scene we come in on, she's like, all right, listen up, class. Now, boys, if a girl ever tells you...
Yeah. She I'm pretty sure she's drunk most of the time.
Yeah.
There is a scene eventually where she does go drinking with Madoka's mom.
Yeah.
They are drinking buddies,
yeah,
and, like, long-term friends, and I think that's wonderful.
It's so good.
Anyways, so that day, it is announced that there is a transfer student who came in from the hospital. She was hospitalized for most of the year, so this is, like, the first time that she is being seen at the school, that she is visiting school and partaking in school. This is Homura Akemi, who is quiet and mysterious. And Homura goes up to Madoka, who is the, like, class rep. And the teacher is like, hey, Madoka, why don't you show Homura around the school? And so Madoka, it kind of shyly but politely, starts getting up and guiding Homura, giving her a tour. But Homura seems to know where they're going already.
Yeah.
And in general is acting really weird. I believe later that day, Madoka is going shopping with Sayaka and Hitomi. And while they are doing so, Madoka sees this white little critter and follows it into, like, a utility zone of the shopping mall.
Yeah, like a very industrial kind of,
like,
know,
the boiler room.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Homura walks out from the darkness and shoots this critter.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the hell? Also, this critter doesn't really look like an animal that exists. It's like sort of fox-like, sort of cat-like.
Yeah, it looks like a cross between a Sanrio character and a Sylveon.
Yeah, a Sanrion.
Yeah.
However, not only is Homura there and trying to kill this critter, but Homura is stopped, and the critter is protected, along with Madoka and Sayaka, by a woman, or a girl, with beautiful curly golden locks.
Oh.
And also a gun.
Yeah, and also a gun.
And this is Mami Tomoe. Mami is a magical girl. So is Homura. They don't know why Homura is trying to kill this little critter, but the little critter is Kyubei, the being who grants wishes by forming contracts with girls to make them magical girls. Essentially, they become a magical girl, which means they gain the ability to fight witches. But by doing so, they are granted one wish. Note, I said witch, W-I-T-C-H, and wish,
W-I-S-H.
Those are two different things. I'm sorry if I kind of skip over syllables and make it hard to understand. So after all this happens, they agree to follow Mommy to her apartment, and that's where episode one ends. There's a lot of confusion, as you can see.
Yep.
Why is Homura trying to kill this critter? What's that about? Who is this new girl? What's the deal with the magical girls in this magical girl series? When does Madoka become one? Who is Homura? What's her deal?
And most importantly, what about Hitomi?
Yeah. Episode 2 opens in the apartment. Mommy explains how magical girls make contracts and all the witch and wish stuff. And Madoka and Sayaka are like, hell yeah, we're in. We want to help out and stop witches from killing people.
Yeah.
And Mommy is like, yeah, maybe we should like hold off on that. You know what? I'll have you accompany me on a like an excursion.
Yeah, let's go on a field trip and see how you like it.
And from that, you can decide if you want to or not. And at some point during the or after this point, Homura like suddenly appears to Madoka while she's just kind of walking and is like, Madoka, whatever you do, do not make a contract. And Madoka's just creeped out, because remember, Homura tried to shoot Kyubei with a gun.
Yeah.
And I mean an actual gun.
Yeah, Homura's ability is gun.
Yeah. So, they agree to follow Mommy into what is a witch labyrinth. A witch labyrinth is a weird, surreal place, sort of a plane or pocket dimension. Or
yeah.
Something along those lines.
So the way that it is denoted in series is, as mentioned previously, the labyrinths are specifically the point at which it becomes very, like, mixed media. Sometimes you will get a lot of, like, collage-based animation. Sometimes you'll get, like clothen renders or sort of like,
yeah,
you know, like physical pictures.
Yeah.
Pictures of like an actual button, you know, that sort of thing.
Some very loose, sketchy drawings,
yeah,
of like caricatures rather than characters.
It is a very like striking way to differentiate, considering that obviously both are animated. It's a very striking way to differentiate real world from labyrinth. And they often use that fact to pepper in a lot of like very specific, very like artistic details regarding,
yeah,
each individual witch.
There's a lot of symbolism.
Yes.
Not just for the labyrinth, but for the entire goddamn series.
God, yes.
There's a lot of symbolism. It's so much symbolism. I can't even begin to talk about it because we're only on episode 2. But Mommy has her own gun powers.
Yes.
She summons, like, rifles, whereas Homura uses pistols. Mommy,
yeah,
also has streamers, like, gymnastic streamers.
It's worth kind of specifically noting
or
that, like...
ribbon?
It's, yeah, ribbons. It's worth noting that, like, Mommy's guns are, like you said, they're kind of like muskets, very, you know, long barrel. They're all one shot, and then she, like, throws it away. Homura's guns are just like a fucking Glock.
Yeah.
Like she just rolls up with a fucking Scorpion SMG.
Yeah. They do fight the witch, or Mommy fights the witch, kills the witch, and the witch drops this little orb, this sort of gem. It's very dark and black, and it is known as a grief seed. Mommy picks it up and holds it to a soul gem, which is a different orb that the magical girls have.
Yeah.
And she puts it up to her soul gem, and it, like, clears the darkness from the grief seed, and then it disappears. That is not explained.
Yep.
I think during either this episode or episode 3, we get some great landscape shots of, like, Madoka and Sayaka just walking.
Yes.
And I want to talk about this because the city they live in is a interesting place.
The staging is so good throughout the series.
Yeah, it's very maximalist in a way, where details that would make up a city are repeated and grown and expanded to an absurd degree, such as they pass by this like industrial park that has just a billion pipes, but then also has like a billion wind turbines.
Yeah. Yeah, the wind turbine specifically. There is a scene in one of the, like, mid to later episodes where Madoka and Sayaka are talking. I think it's after Sayaka becomes a magical girl.
Spoiler.
Spoilers. But there's a scene where they are talking and they are sitting in front of a riverbank, and then beyond that riverbank is, like, you know, big green hill, and then it is just an entire field of, like, wind turbines. And it's the sort of thing where it is so visually striking that you look at it and you have to assume it has some kind of symbolism, some kind of meaning, like...
Almost surreal.
Yeah.
I think another important point to note that I think will add more context is that the gothic horror elements, or the gothic elements, don't just expand to the labyrinths, but in a way to the architecture within the city.
Yeah.
There is a lot of architecture that does look modern. I think their school in particular has a lot of elements that are strange in, like, the, like, glass and steel core that is a lot of modern architecture. But the fences on the rooftop of their school are, like, very gothic buttress style.
Yeah, they're ornate.
They're ornate. They are almost like upside down portcullises.
Yeah.
They're spiky and pointy at the top with, you know, flourishes and bars and whatnot. And this doesn't match the rest of the school. I think you might see that in other anime when they have, like, an elegant academy. But this isn't that. This is, like, a public school. And so it is a very striking choice there to make this fence a very unique fence that doesn't even look like a fence you would see on a school. It has elements of, like, a sort of storybook or fairy tale castle to it.
Yeah.
There's also a bridge that plays prominent in the series. A bridge, like a pedestrian bridge that goes over a highway. And the bridge is, like, diamond-shaped with little gaps between the pathways. It's something that you definitely could see, but it is not a bridge that exists purely for municipal reasons. This is, like, an art bridge.
Yeah.
It feels like a... Like, the diamond aspect is makes me think of Alice in Wonderland or, like, that sort of royal motif.
I think the thing that came to mind when I saw it was the, like, sky platform map from GoldenEye.
Yeah, sure.
Like, you know, hate to be fine. My reference, but... Yeah, because it is, like, it exclusively exists for the purpose of the cool staging of being able to put the camera down and seeing, like, the highway underneath it. But it's so sick! Like, it is... The designs of the world itself, of, like, the city that they're in, also, like, really do kind of give this... It gives kind of a foreboding, like, sense, an ominous sense. Because, like you mentioned with the school, one of the things that I love with the school is that it is entirely glass. Like, there are some metal separators, but it is almost wholly glass walls, which gives this, like, panopticon sort of effect.
Oh, mentioned panopticon.
Yep.
Panopticon mentioned. I always compare it to in Hitman in the New York level. There's these glass booths, and you can get, like, some of the targets alone in them, but you have to find a way to prevent people from seeing you. This is, like, it's not just that the walls of the building are glass, but the classrooms themselves are glass with, like, hallways between them. They're, like, pods. It's also, like, the bureaucracy level from Obsidian, which is a less known reference. But, you know, you can look it up if you want.
Yeah.
I love this because it's very fantastical, which I think adds to this air, not just of ominous warnings or foreboding warnings, but just sort of a surrealist air of, like, unease and mystery. There's a sort of conceptual fog where you recognize that these are traits of a city, but it feels like they've been stretched in an odd way. It kind of is, like, it reminds me a bit of, like, René Magritte.
Have I seen this artist's work?
Almost
this
is a painter? Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
It's got, like, the bowler hat guys and...
Yeah.
Episode 3 is a very important one.
Yes!
For many reasons, as we talked about. Keep in mind, so far we have followed the Urobuchi plan of hook, I guess, line.
Yeah.
In this case, the line is the explanations. So we've got a sinker coming.
Yeah.
So, episode 3 is our first introduction to Kyosuke Kamijo, who is a sickly boy in the hospital. He used to play violin.
He still does, but he doesn't.
Because an accident left him with his hand, like, pretty badly broken. And he's in recovery, but he doesn't think he'll be able to ever play the violin again.
Yeah, there's scenes throughout the series of, you know, the main character who is, like, connected to him is Sayaka. There's scenes of, like, Sayaka, you know, sitting somewhere where a doctor is like, oh, yeah, poor boy, his hand, you know, he'll probably make a full recovery, but his hands will never allow him to play violin again.
Yeah, and he was, like, a prodigy, too.
Yeah.
He was highly lauded for this. So, yeah, he is Sayaka's childhood friend, and Sayaka has a crush on him, though it's very unrequited, and it's unclear if it's one-sided or not. So, Sayaka visits Kyosuke at the hospital, they listen to classical music together, but he's just super depressed.
Yeah, he's very distant.
Yeah. Later that night, Homura breaks into Madoka's house to tell her not to make a contract. Homura just does this, and it's sort of... It has been a giant part of memes in, like, in-jokes in the fan base of Homura just stalking Madoka and breaking into her house just to tell her not to make a contract. There's a pretty famous, like, little comic of Madoka, like, washing her hair, and it's like, oh no, I'm out of shampoo. I might have to form a contract. And then Homura just shows up holding a shampoo bottle and is like, that won't be necessary. Because that is kind of something that'll happen, but we'll get to that later. Also, a grief seed appears in the hospital. I think this is while Sayaka is visiting Kamijo, or like when she visits him the next day.
Yeah.
Madoka and Sayaka are walking together to the hospital. They notice that a labyrinth is forming. Sayaka runs into the labyrinth to see if anyone's trapped inside, and Madoka goes to get Mommy. Homura tries to stop Mommy and tell her that this is a particularly dangerous witch, but Mommy decides to wrap Homura up in, like, her streamer ribbon things.
Yeah.
And is like, you tried to kill Kyubei. I'm not going to trust you. You probably just want Sayaka to die. Mommy and Madoka go in. Homura, I think, only appears once they've actually entered the labyrinth, but that's when Mommy wraps her up. Mommy transforms into a magical girl and starts fighting this witch, which looks sort of like... Well, I guess first it looks like Kasane Tedo.
Yes, it does.
Like a tiny version of like pinkish reddish hair with its own tiny little head curls.
Yeah, this creature is relevant again in the movie, and it
don't
like
spoil that.
You know, I'm not saying how it's relevant, just that it is relevant again in the movie, and like, yeah, you kind of get a better look at it, and it really is Kasane Tedo core. It's very, very close.
Yeah. And note that Kasane Tedo was already a well-known Utao by that point. Like, Fukureta had been a few years old already.
Yeah.
For example. And Triple Baka as well. If you want to know more about that, listen to our Hatsune Miku Vocaloid episode. Unhappy Refrain episode. But the witches all have, like, summons, by the way. They have little guys that fight for them.
Yeah.
And all the little guys are themed troops, and if you're into that sort of thing, it's great.
It's really, really fucking cool.
Also, the arena is, like, covered in sweets.
Yes. Also, something you didn't note about the, like, big eel fuck creature. It looks very specifically... like early 1900s animation. Like,
yeah,
very.
So that's the thing, is as Mommy fights this Kasane Tedo looking ass thing, it then turns into this giant eel.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's very Cuphead.
Yeah.
It predated Cuphead by a decade, but like, you know.
I don't want to just say Disney because I have a specific like reference in mind. Like, I want to say it's like Dumbo is the reference I have in mind. Sort of like there's a little bit of pink elephants in there, I think.
Yeah.
With like the color on his face and whatnot. But
sort of looks like a clown
yeah,
face.
Yeah.
I think is a good comparison. During the fight, Mommy gets like constricted by this eel and it opens its mouth and bites Mommy's head off.
Yep. So, this is one of the most famous slash infamous deaths in anime.
Yeah.
Of literally all time.
Yeah. Like, you know how many deaths there are in Game of Thrones that have become completely infamous? how many like red weddings or hold the doors there are. This is that for anime. Like, this is a huge one. It was even controversial in the staff at Shaft, the Shaft staff. They tried to convince Urobuchi to change the screenplay. Like, please do not kill her. This is a great character. You don't do it. But he was very steadfast. He was like, nope, has to happen.
Yeah.
And it became a big part of the series' reputation and legacy and identity. It is the third episode twist that Urobuchi so wanted to include, and it more than succeeded at that.
So I want to just slide in, and I will keep this very quick and say that I am somebody who knew about Madoka exclusively through memes and exclusively through sort of like cultural osmosis. And so I knew that the twist was coming, TM. I did not know exactly when. And so when I initially saw, you know, her get constricted and then the witch, like, reel its head back and open its jaw, in my mind, I was like, ah, so this is like a flash forward to when she eventually dies, right? And then it happened, and I was like, wait, it's episode 3?
It is really funny to have known the plot twist, but then also be surprised
by it.
Like, you kind of lucked out in your lapse of judgment.
Exactly. It was, like, kind of still perfect.
Yeah. This is a huge moment. I think it is incredible for, not just for the shock value of, like, finally firmly planting this is what the series is. These are the stakes. The characters will die and it will be sad.
Yeah.
Like, that was a big part of it, that, like, up till now there had been violence, or at least, like, implied deaths, in the sense that mainly Homura has a gun and she can shoot, but like this is lethal.
Yeah, this is on-screen death of beloved character we've just gotten to know and love
with blood.
Yeah.
And so, like, for the audience, this was the first real confirmation of how far the series would go. It was kind of pulling its punches up till this point by easing us in slowly, but this was going to be a dark and gritty Magical Girl series, and that's what this episode said.
Yeah.
Also, killing the mentor character is big. Mami is the most capable character in many ways.
Yeah.
Like, she's strong, she's cool, she's, like, peak of every possible stat and trait you could have. She's elegant, she hosts tea parties, she lives in an apartment.
I have a note for... that's a good fucking point, actually.
And it's like a nice apartment, too. Yeah,
she's a third year in high school and she has an apartment. Actually, hang on, wait. I don't know that that's... That might not be strange in Japan. I wouldn't know, I suppose. But, like...
But it's a nice apartment. This isn't just like a, you're moving to Tokyo for school. Yeah, this isn't studio apartment. So.
Yeah, this is like... ornate. She has a triangle shaped like cafe table. I have a note for the movie because it, like, she kind of shows it a lot more in the movie, but yeah, like, Mami really is probably the most competent, probably like the general smartest, quote-unquote, of the magical girls.
Yeah.
And so the fact that she does die, like, once again, this is another kind of key into Homer and probably knew she was going to die and tried to warn her.
Yeah. Madoka is a tragedy. Like, in terms of the classical classification of the series.
Yeah.
From a narrative perspective, it is a tragedy where things get worse and characters respond to that emotionally. But, like, the series continues to get not worse as in quality, but, like, worse situations for the characters.
Yeah.
I think there is sort of a underlying feeling with both the characters and the audience that the one person who was trustworthy and knew what was going on died.
Yeah.
Like, Mami was also the explainer for a lot of the mechanics of Magical Girls. She was the voice of reason in many ways, of being like, you know, maybe you shouldn't just become a magical girl. But she was also friendlier than Homura, and the audience still doesn't know whether to trust Homura or not. So, like, I think the two-episode pace of letting people get used to Mami also helped give the audience more, like, a stronger reaction.
Yeah.
Because she was not only the character that is, a beloved character who's nice, but is also, like, key to understanding what's going on.
Yeah.
And throughout the rest of the series, her absence is very notable.
It's also kind of worth noting that we don't get a lot of her specific backstory, at the very least in the media, very specifically that we are talking about. But the one little clue in when she is talking about why did you form your contract? Why did you make your wish? And she mentions that, you know, in her case, she didn't have much of a choice. And we flash back to her in a car crash looking up and seeing Kyubey looking down at her. So, like, we get implication and, like, obviously visually on screen, but not a whole lot of other details regarding Mommy's tragic backstory.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's there is a surprising amount of heavy lifting done in just a few chapters to endear you to a character that then, as far as the original series is concerned, is gone for 75% of it.
Yep. So episode 4, Madoka is traumatized.
Yeah, the series does, I think, a decent job of spacing it out. Like, I'm not going to say that I think Madoka reacts realistically or anything like that, because there is still an amount of, like, she did just see somebody die, but she still, like, goes to school, I think. Or no, is she notably missing on the next day? Isn't that what
happens?
Yeah.
I know that, so, a sort of side, I don't want to say plot, but Madoka's relationship with her mom is really strained because of all the magical girl stuff. Madoka doesn't feel like she can open up to her mom, that she'll understand or even believe her. Madoka saw her friend die to a monster, but she doesn't feel like she can tell her mom about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And her mom knows that Madoka is, like, deeply troubled by something, but she can't force her to say anything.
Which I want to say, in terms of, like, you know, the idea of that being applied to, you know, a girl like you, TM, I think that's really good and salient of, like, you know, having something as a teenager or, you know, a preteen or something like that, where you can't, you know, for one reason or another, can't communicate it to your parent, even though you have a parent that is trying to be understanding. Like, I think that is good and interesting.
I feel the need to note, by the way, that Madoka is not a show aimed towards kids or little
yeah.
girls or even necessarily teenagers. The fact that there is a death with blood where a character's head gets bit off, this is a show for adults. I kind of want to make that clear, because while we did talk about how the genre is geared historically towards girls, young girls specifically, that's not necessarily the case with Madoka and its target audience.
Yeah.
Madoka's traumatized. Sayaka is also traumatized, but has a newfound resolve to make a contract with Kyubey. I believe this also comes after Sayaka has an argument with Kyosuke.
Yeah, Kyosuke.
Kyosuke kind of snaps at Sayaka because Sayaka keeps trying to listen to classical music with him.
Yeah, she keeps, like, coming to him and being like, you know, oh, I got, you know, another CD of classical music. Let's listen to it together. And, like, it's something where, yeah, she sort of thinks that she is coming to him and being nice and, like, being kind, trying to, like, make this connection, even though he doesn't have this ability. But for him, who, you know, previously was this prodigy and has now lost the wheels to his life in his mind, like, it's this very, like, picking at a scab kind
yeah.
of thing.
He's like, don't you realize how much this hurts?
Yeah.
Because to him, it's just a reminder of what he lost and what he'll never be able to do. And so after that, Sayaka knows what her wish will be. Additionally, since Mommy died and Sayaka does not trust Homura whatsoever, even more, I think. She has less trust than even Mommy did.
Yeah.
And certainly less trust than Madoka does.
Sayaka as a character is like, Sayaka is one of those characters who acts irrationally because she is a kind of impulsive, irrational person, which does not make her a bad character. Arguably, that makes her a very good and interesting character.
Look, I don't know if I need to say this every time, but humans act irrationally, characters act irrationally.
Yeah.
Anyone who believes a character can act with ration and logic and reason just doesn't understand humans. Sayaka wishes to be a magical girl, and her wish is for Kyosuke to heal, to make a full recovery. But we don't get a chance at that for now, because cut to Madoka, who, on her way home from something, I don't remember exactly what, probably school, she notices Hitomi, who is sort of wandering in a daze, like in a trance, and, yeah. And Madoka calls out to her and she doesn't respond, so she follows Hitomi and sees that Hitomi, along with a bunch of other people, are kind of mindlessly waltzing into a warehouse. And not only that, okay, so content warning, this is going to get even darker as we go, but we are going to discuss suicide, and so please keep that in mind. There are other content warnings, and we will, of course, put those at the front and in the description, but also point out when they will come into play if you have specific triggers for those.
Yeah.
So these people are essentially being mind-controlled to kill themselves in a mass suicide.
Yeah, it's like a big, like, industrial kind of area where they mix chloroform. I think it's chloroform yeah. gas, yeah.
They're doing the old cleaning solution.
Yeah, yeah.
That kills you. And Madoka, like, she sees this and essentially picks up the bucket they're about to drop one of the cleaning fluids in and, like,
yeah,
sloshes it out. And the people being mind-controlled all start, like, attacking her and chasing her. And Madoka, like, desperately tries to run away, almost gets caught and, like, killed by them. But she is saved by Sayaka. Sayaka, the magical girl outfits, kind of follow a very, hate this term, completely different, but a very Lolita fashion style.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with the book. Or
the gothic Lolita style.
Yes.
Specifically.
It is a specific, well, maybe not gothic, because there's a whole world of Lolita fashion that has a level
sure,
of...
Sure, sure.
While gothic Lolita is definitely based off of, like, a lot of frills and lace and very heavy layers and thick clothing and, like, bonnets and sort of what would be considered, like, Victorian or pre-Victorian era, like, fashion for nobility, there are also a lot of subgenres. Think of it like how there is goth, and then there's, like, pastel goth.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
then
yeah.
There's other forms of, like, fashion that are similar to goth, but are not goth.
Yeah.
And when people say goth, they think of, like, black eyeliner and piercings and fishnets, but that's not what it all is. And, like, so essentially, again, nothing to do with the book, or the term that spawned from the book. Keep that in mind. Very important to know when discussing fashion. It's a whole different thing.
Also very important to know when discussing specifically anime as well.
I think also you can think of it as doll clothing to be worn by humans.
Yeah, yeah.
That's sort of the concept is...
Yeah, it's very, like, high, cute, very, like, lots of dresses, lots of flowy clothing yeah. sometimes, lots of ribbons.
So think of, like, a fancy porcelain doll, but to be worn by a person. That's sort of the intent behind a lot of Lolita fashion as well. But just as fashion is diverse and doll fashion is diverse, this is diverse. So, like,
yeah.
I think generally the poofiness, the lace, the as far as the flourishes and lace goes and the frills and the poofiness is more so what the characters in Madoka are sporting. Especially Mami, who is sort of the most, like, traditional magical girl, except Madoka, who we have not seen in a magical girl outfit except for in the opening.
Yeah, yeah.
Homura looks more like a sailor uniform that you would see on a school character in an anime. Sayaka is wearing, like, a corset, and it definitely has sort of a skirt, but
it's
she has
sporty.
More of a coat, almost?
Yeah.
She is dressed like Princess Knight.
Yeah, okay. Because I was about to say, it's very, like, sporty, but also very, like, adventure-y.
Yeah. I think some elements are also inspired by Revolutionary Girl Utena, which is another very popular anime among trans women and leftists.
That one, Revolutionary Girl Utena, I think, was kind of the one a little bit before Sailor Moon was. Do I remember?
I'm not sure on the timeline, but it's definitely a more mature version of Princess Knight in a lot of ways.
Okay, yeah.
And Sayaka sort of continues this tradition of girl knight characters expressing sort of tomboyishness in unusual gender roles or sort of breaking gender norms via knighthood.
It's also worth noting a very fun detail that you kind of pointed out to me is that Sayaka... So, Mommy, as you may remember, Mommy's weapons were all, like, muskets, and I don't know if it was pointed out before, but she, like, spawns, you know, an entire array of muskets. She, like, she does the thing where she shoots one and then throws it away and then spawns another one or grabs whatever one she spawned right next to her and then, you know, just does that out all the time that she's shooting. Sayaka ends up getting swords, but she kind of specifically ends up with an ability similar to Mommy's where she spawns a bunch of swords and can, you know, throw them, use them as she needs and whatnot, which is really, like, sweet and really fun that she ended up with a weapon directly inspired by Mommy's as, you know, a mentor figure for her.
Yeah. Sayaka is, like, she looks up to Mommy tremendously.
Yeah.
And so she is inspired by her in her fighting style. You could say she has unlimited blade.
Yes!
So...
Do they work?
I guess so. So also, at the end of this episode, there is a short sort of glance at a new character who's like, huh, so the girl in this area died. I guess that means I can move in on some new turf. And we don't know who that is yet.
Yep.
Episode 5. Sayaka is following a witch's familiar, which is a witch that hasn't fully evolved into a witch. This is like the tadpole stage. And Madoka's also there. She's also following Sayaka, who is following the witch's familiar.
She's got a golf club. And she's wearing glasses. And Teddy is there.
Yeah. And Yosuke is not there. He's not in the party.
Sounds like someone ordered a stupid-looking witch.
So, Sayaka tries to kill the witch's familiar, but she is stopped by the character from the short glance on the previous episode.
Oh, it's a fast-forward to the next episode.
Kyoko Sakura. Kyoko is even more brash and sort of tomboyish than Sayaka somehow.
Yeah, she's very feisty.
She is a rude girl. She shoplifts.
She skanks.
Maybe. I wouldn't be surprised.
Honestly, yeah, I could see Kyoko.
So, by the way, the characters are all color-coded. Madoka has pink hair and pink outfit. Homura has, like, black, dark purple hair and a dark purple outfit. Mommy had yellow hair, yellow outfit, Sayaka, blue hair, pronouns. And then Kyoko is red hair, red outfit.
Yeah.
Her magical girl costume is more of like a Chinese dress.
Yeah, yeah.
The type you might see a, like Chun-Li wear.
Yeah.
Like a woman martial artist. And her weapon is like a halberd. I think it even has like a little banner on the back of it or like a streamer or something.
Yeah. Is it a chain halberd or just a halberd?
I don't remember. But she stops Sayaka and Sayaka is like, what the fuck? I was going to kill that so we could save people's lives. Because Sayaka views this as like a superhero thing.
Yeah.
She's making a noble sacrifice for the greater good. Witches cause deaths and bad emotions and like mass suicides. Sayaka wants to stop that now before it has a risk of hurting anyone, including her. But Kyoko says it's not mature, so it won't drop a grief seed. They don't explain why that matters, including Kyubei, who's there, by the way. Madoka's just been carrying Kyubei for, like, the past 5 days.
Yeah, for the past 5 episodes.
Kyubei's even been, like, sleeping in Madoka's bedroom.
Yeah.
Weirdo. But Sayaka and Kyoko are fighting, but they are interrupted by Homura, who pretty much only stops them because Madoka was about to make a wish to Kyubei to stop the two from fighting. She was like, I'm going to make a contract so that they don't fight. And Homura just goes, that will not be necessary. Madoka she's rash to act in a way, but she gets stopped from doing so.
Madoka is like too kind for her own good.
Yeah.
You know?
She's very kind and she is passive, but some of that is because she is denied the ability to act on a situation. If anything, the fact that she stopped all those people from committing suicide was a pretty big deal.
Yeah. I do not think Madoka is a character that gets sidelined, so to speak. She's a character that has agency, but like you said, it's that her agency doesn't really matter, quote unquote, in the greater context of the series for a long time, which is in and of itself also sort of part of the point,
yeah,
capital T, the point.
She doesn't get sidelined by the writers, but she does kind of get sidelined by the characters.
Yeah, exactly.
She is made an observer by the other characters. That's pretty much most of episode 5.
Yeah, episode 5 is mostly just, hey, we got this new character, Kyoko, and she, oh, she's a feist. Oh, they don't like her. Oh man, they're button heads.
Yep. So episode 6, Kyubey reveals to Sayaka that all girls have an amount of potential that he can sense that indicates how strong they will be when they become magical girls. For some reason, Madoka's potential is ridiculously huge. Like, bigger than anyone he's ever seen. And that's why he so desperately wants to make Madoka into a magical girl. Because of that huge potential. Meanwhile, Homura meets Kyoko, and Kyoko, she sort of treats this like a turf war sort of deal.
Yeah.
Essentially, the magical girls all have their own turf that is like their hunting ground, and it's rude to invade others.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she moved into the city because mommy died, though she didn't know at first that Homura was also there. Homura being a very experienced magical girl, clearly. And Kyoko is trying to just like negotiate a bit. Homura tells Kyoko that there is a huge-ass witch called Walpurgis Knot coming in like a week or something. And this is going to be a problem. So they agree to form a temporary truce / ceasefire / alliance to deal with Walpurgis Knot, because Homura needs as much help as she can.
I'd like to note, by the way, I don't remember if this meeting specifically happens in, like, Homura's home, apartment, whatever, reified space, because notably Homura's den, I'm gonna call it, it has art on the walls, and I think that there's like a it has like slightly blue tones, but the big centerpiece is this massive swinging chandelier, but like an axe.
Yeah,
like it's like a four-way like morning star axe that is just constantly like rotating a little bit above.
It's a pendulum, like a clock pendulum. Yeah. It's also sort of a sword of Damocles.
Yeah. Ugh, the imagery in this fucking series is so good.
So, Kyoko and Sayaka meet up on the Diamond Bridge, and they fight each other. Like, it's like on-site for Sayaka. She's like, I am so fucking pissed at you.
Yeah.
Before they can actually start, like, before they transform into their magical girl forms, Madoka takes Sayaka's soul gem, which is, like, the thing they need to transform. It's their version of the magic artifact that grants them unlimited power. Awesome. Is it awesome magic powers? Is that what He-Man says? Fabulous magic powers?
Phenomenal cosmic powers?
Something like that. Anyways, she takes that and yeets it off the bridge onto, like, the bed of a truck.
Yeah.
And Sayaka passes out.
So, it's worth maybe noting that, just to highlight, what we know of, like, the grief seeds and the soul seed, the soul gem, is that, like, you use magic, your soul gem dims, you get a grief seed from some witches, not all, they are not always dropped, but sometimes a witch drops a grief seed, and you use that grief seed to, like, suck up the black. To suck up the, like, lack of color, which refills your soul gem. That's the only thing we specifically kind of know about the mechanism.
I'm pretty sure
speak.
Before this point, you only know that the soul gem purifies the grief seed.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't remember if they explain that using magic makes your soul gem grow darker at this point.
I think that's something that Mommy mentions, but I think it's the sort of thing that isn't, like, highlighted until this point.
Yeah, maybe. But so, Sayaka, like, goes limp and passes out. Homura, I don't remember, I think Homura has shown her actual abilities by this point. She has time-stopping abilities.
Yeah.
And she uses that to essentially catch up to the truck that has the soul gem. Meanwhile, Sayaka is, like, not only passed out, but she doesn't have a pulse.
Yeah.
She is, by all means, dead from whatever just happened. Kyoko's freaking out. Madoka is obviously incredibly distraught. And Kyubey, the motherfucker, is like, don't you understand? That was her soul you threw away. her body doesn't have her soul net nearby now. Finally, Homura retrieves it and returns back, and Sayaka kind of wakes up, and Kyubey explains that the soul gem is Sayaka's body.
Yeah.
The process of becoming a magical girl essentially turns the girl's body into a soul gem, and then their body is actually a, like, projection or a puppet or a replica or a simulacra.
Yeah.
That they move and they control and they puppet, but that's not their real body anymore. And part of that is because if they took damage while they were transformed, if that was their real body, they would die from, like, the pain and the shock.
Yeah.
Much less getting your head chopped off, but, like, any sort of deep wound would actually cause enough shock and pain to pass out. But by essentially becoming numb, they're able to avoid that and fight these strong enemies.
By dissociating.
Yeah. So when Madoka threw the soul gem, it cut the connection, the local connection. And so the like Sayaka puppet that they were with passed out.
Yeah.
While the soul gem housing her soul and body and all that was on the truck. And this is something that Kyoko did not know, and seemingly Homura did not know. It's unclear if Homura knew this fact that the soul gem was the real body or not.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is, I think, one of the big points where Kyubey really starts to show his colors.
Yeah, he shows his hand a little too much here.
Yeah, they're like, why didn't you tell us about this before we made the contract?
And he's like, you didn't ask.
Yeah, he's like, I didn't think it would be a big deal. I mean, you get to be practically invincible. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you got a wish.
Yeah.
Don't forget, I gave you a wish. I literally gave you your whole wish.
Yeah. That is the end point, the big twist at the end of episode 6.